Welcome to Lightning in a Bottle, the essential podcast for middle market business owners, key stakeholders, and the advisors who guide them. I'm Josh Pottinger and joined by my co-host, Jason Chirogiannis. Together, we lead ATX Wealth Partners, a private wealth management team at UBS here in Austin, Texas. Now, over the course of almost 30 years, we've built a vibrant community and have curated a suite of resources tailored for your success, from insightful white papers and cutting-edge research to exclusive in-person events and expert-led podcasts. We are here to provide the tools that you need. Now, if you're considering an exit, this is likely the most significant financial decision of your life, and typically, you only have one chance to get it right. So our mission is clear: to arm you with the knowledge to enhance the value of your business, navigate a successful sale, and of course, optimize your post-exit financial outcomes. Now with that, let's dive in and unlock the strategies that will prepare you for a prosperous future. Hello, everyone. It's Josh Pottinger here, and I'm excited for episode number 26, everyone. We're going to be talking about a fun topic today called rep and warranty insurance. And I've got an old friend that I've recently reconnected with, Matt Weiner. Matt, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
So Matt is a person that I got to know over 20 years ago now when I was at my former firm, Morgan Stanley. And Matt's been busy over the last 20 years doing some really cool stuff, particularly in this space more recently. So Matt is a managing director with Aon, and he's a co-practice leader for their transaction liability team. So in this role, Matt's responsible for the development and implementation of transactional-based risk solutions, including the deployment of insurance capital for M&A transactions through rep and warranty insurance, litigation, tax, and other contingent liabilities insurance. And so before he was with Aon, he was with Vinson and Elkins, was an attorney over there, and he specialized in corporate finance, securities law matters, mergers and acquisitions, private equity. He's been around this space for many, many years. And so, you know, over the past few years, our vision is to be a trusted resource for those owners and key stakeholders out there of private companies that are preparing for an exit. And one of the things that is a critical piece of this conversation nowadays is rep and warranty insurance. And so we thought it'd be a good idea to have Matt on the show today to talk about that. So let's kick it off here, Matt. Let's just go ahead and dive right in. What is transaction insurance?
Sure. So I think it's helpful to kind of take a step back and think about M&A as it existed 10 to 15 years ago, because I think it helps set the stage for what we see today and what we call transaction insurance. So if you look back at M&A historically, you have parties that enter into negotiations to, you know, buy or sell a company or businesses. And generally during that process, a buyer is going to undertake due diligence. They're going to look under the hood of the target company. They're going to have discussions with the management team or with the owners of that company. And ultimately, they're going to negotiate a purchase agreement. And as a part of that purchase agreement negotiation, one of the things that routinely comes up is, well, you've told us everything there is to know about the business. We've done our own diligence. We think we know everything that's there. But over the next year or two, as we're integrating this business and running it, what happens if something wasn't disclosed, mm-hmm. right? And there's plenty mm-hmm. of examples, but I think an easy one to understand is your company didn't pay taxes somewhere where they were supposed to pay those taxes. And now the new purchaser of that company is on the hook for those taxes. And so the way parties historically have handled this is they've said, okay, seller, we're going to give you $100 million for your company. But we're going to take 10 to 20% of that, $10 to $20 million, and we're going to put it in an escrow account for 1 to 2 years so that during that time period, if something goes wrong, we're going to claw back at that escrow. And as you can imagine, this is a very contentious part of a negotiation. Sellers want to take home all their money at closing. Mm-hmm. Buyers want as much protection as they can get. Even if you agree to some amount of holdback, how long? Is it 6 months? Is it a year? Is it 2 years? And so what was born out of this challenge, if you will, was the idea of, well, what if there's a third party who's willing to take that risk of something existing at the company that the parties didn't know about? Who's willing to take that risk on and say, you know what? We'll take that risk on our balance sheet so you guys can transact easier. And the answer is insurance companies. So, you know, fortunately, there is a tremendous amount of data on M&A transactions. How often do transactions result in a buyer seeking recourse against a seller? What are the types of things they seek recourse for? And so over the last 10 years, we've seen this development of transaction insurance with the intent being to put both parties in the transaction in a better place. So when implemented and constructed correctly, ideally the seller is able to take home 100% of the proceeds or close thereto at closing, right? So there's, you don't have 10 to 20% of your purchase price being held up. And the buyer now has an insurance policy with very reputable A-rated insurers, names that people would be very familiar with. And that insurance policy is generally going to be much broader in protection and what it will cover a buyer for. And it will survive a much longer period of time than that traditional 1 to 2 years that they would have gotten recourse from a seller. So where you end up is you have a buyer who now has an insurance policy, and they're able to be indemnified or reimbursed under that policy for some underlying issue that existed at the seller's company, mm-hmm. while at the same time affording the seller the clean exit so they can either, you know, go off to their home in the Bahamas, or even if they're staying on the company, not having to worry about their new partner who they're working for having to seek recourse against them mm-hmm. as they've now moved into a place where they're now partners.
Mm-hmm. Who's typically bringing this topic up? I would imagine it's got to be the seller.
You know, interestingly, I would say if you looked back again, 7 to 10 years ago when this really started to take off, it was the seller building this into their sales process. Mm-hmm. So either through their investment bankers who were running an auction or through their attorneys who were negotiating the purchase agreement, they would kind of build in from the outset the idea of, we don't want to provide recourse to you. We would like for you to seek an insurance policy. And they would engage a broker like Aon to go out and confirm the availability of insurance coverage for that transaction. What we have now seen is those same sellers, in many cases private equity funds, who are now buyers in transactions, have now effectively accepted that this is a much easier and more efficient way to do M&A. Mm-hmm. It leads to a much simpler process in negotiating the purchase agreement. Because think about it, now you're not fighting over every word around representations and warranties, and you're not fighting over indemnity provisions. You're able to really just focus on the commercial points of the business, and the rest of the purchase agreement flows much more seamlessly in terms of what you're actually focused on. So we now see buyers saying, look, number one, we think it's much easier to seek recourse against an insurance policy than going after a seller. We think that the advantages and benefits of the policy, again, being much broader than what a seller would indemnify us for, is enhanced. And so buyers are now actually at the forefront oftentimes in implementing this because they just want to have a more seamless process and in some cases be more competitive, right? They, mm-hmm. they may see other buyers in a transaction and say, how do we differentiate ourselves from the other three buyers in this process? Well, let's offer the seller a clean break. So it's still very much common to see sellers initiating this from the outset, but it's also not uncommon in a competitive transaction situation to see buyers also looking to implement this early on.
Mm-hmm. So how does a seller implement this type of policy in its sales process?
Yeah, so I think it's going to depend on the type of sales process that they're undertaking. If you've got a client who's going to sell their company through an investment bank, mm-hmm. who's going to go out and say, look, we're going to do multiple rounds. We're going to start off with 200 bidders, and we're going to send them their marketing materials and say, send us your best bid, right? You're going to wait on this construct until you're fairly certain that you've got someone that you're willing to transact with. And so what we would see is typically in a second or third round, where they've narrowed down the prospective field of buyers from, called a much larger number, to 10 or 15. They've presented valuation numbers that the seller's willing to transact at. We often see at that time a seller saying, okay, we're now at a point where we're going to start sending out a purchase agreement, and we're going to ask buyers to kind of tell us what they want to see. It's at this point that we often have the client or their lawyers reach out to us and say, we have a live transaction. We're 6 to 8 weeks away from a potential signing date. We still have multiple bidders in the process, but we're ready to kind of put forth a construct that contemplates R&W insurance, which stands for Representations and Warranties Insurance. When they reach out to us, what that process looks like is really kind of a twofold process. The first is to go out and do a market assessment. And this is where we actually go out to around 25 or so insurance companies who will underwrite a reps and warranties insurance policy. And we present to those insurance companies basically a story of, here's the company that's for sale. Here's what they do. We'll provide any transaction parameters that are unique. You know, sometimes you have sellers, again, that may stay on with the company for some period of time. There may be unique aspects of the business. Perhaps they operate in multiple countries, or they do something that's unique. But it's our opportunity to kind of tell a story to the insurance companies of, here's who these guys are, here's what they're selling, here's what the expected purchase price may look like. And we seek what we call indicative quotes, where the insurers are able to say, yes, we'll underwrite that transaction. Here's the pricing at which we're willing to underwrite the transaction for. And here's what we're going to focus on in underwriting. What questions are we going to need to have answered? And where are we really going to dig in to make sure we're comfortable for the risk that we're accepting? And we'll present those term sheets to the seller and to their advisors. to make sure that, hey, are these all things that you think you'd be able to answer for the underwriter, or the buyer may be able to answer for the underwriter? And then at that point, you know, effectively the sellers and their advisors will continue with negotiation with bidders to move to a more narrowed process where you have, you know, one or two bidders left. And this construct is built in directly to the purchase agreement. Mm-hmm. So the contractual documents between the seller and the buyer will say that there is no recourse against the seller except for fraud. Mm-hmm. So for your clients that are sellers, I mean, this is a contractual requirement that the buyer is not able to claw back at the seller. There is no holdback of escrow. So, you know, 100% of those proceeds flow through to the seller at closing. And it's mandated that the buyer will obtain this policy and look to that policy as its sole recourse for any breach of a representation or warranty.
So you said 6 to 8 weeks out. Is that a, kind of a good time to start beginning that process?
Yeah. At the end of the day, this process takes about 10 to 14 days start to finish.
Oh.
So I can't tell you.
Shorter than I would have thought.
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that we get calls, often from buyers, who say, hey, we just found out, you know, we've been selected to move forward, and the seller just told us they're not giving us an indemnity, and we need to obtain an insurance policy. Can you help out? And we're sprinting to get it done in, you know, less than 2 weeks. The reason we ask for 6 to 8 weeks is it just gives everyone more time to make sure that the coverage is going to be exactly what the parties need. Because as you can expect, during the negotiation of a PSA or a purchase agreement, things come up, right? Diligence is ongoing. Other issues are going to surface that we weren't aware of when we first started the process. Mm-hmm. And so by having more time, it just enables us to facilitate an insurance policy that really is covering everything the buyer and seller want covered. And I can't stress enough, I mean, this is a tool for risk transfer. We are transferring the risks away from sellers and buyers, and we're putting them on the balance sheet of an insurance company. So we always say the more forthcoming the parties can be, the better, because it enables us to really help push those risks over to the insurance company. And I'll give you an example. I mean, we oftentimes have what we call known issues arise, right? So if you think about a traditional transaction, liabilities are risks that are known issues, right? They're there all the time, right? The target may have some litigation that it's subject to. There may be certain issues that they have with a certain material contract around a customer or supplier. Buyers are typically factoring those into their purchase price. Right. I mean, that's typically how buyers and sellers negotiate the purchase price. They say, hey, guys, your company generates $10 million a year of EBITDA. You know, we're going to typically pay a 9 to 10x multiple. So this is a $90 to $100 million transaction. But you've got a couple of things out here that we have to assess as a risk. And if we think they're material enough, you know, we may reduce the purchase price accordingly. And that's a part of kind of the song and dance. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that with reps and warranties insurance, some of those risks can actually be insured. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't necessitate a purchase price adjustment.
Right.
And so not only do sellers, when we implement this insurance, not only do they have the benefit of just getting all of their proceeds at closing, but there's also kind of a distinct possibility that there are certain liabilities that a buyer may have required a purchase price adjustment downward to potentially assume that risk. By us being able to shift it onto the insurance policy, the parties are able to kind of move forward without either party bearing that risk. Mm-hmm. And now we end up with a higher purchase price.
Mm-hmm. So as far as impacting timing, I mean, this deal looks like it can get done relatively quick. I mean, feels like it accelerates the time to close because it's less negotiations around nuances. Would that be accurate or no?
It's very accurate. In fact, if you talk to law firms, you know, who do M&A, I think they'll tell you that when reps and warranties insurance is used, as a general matter, the transaction timing and process is just more efficient. Again, when you're focused on negotiating a PSA, you know, what are the issues that you have to deal with, right? There's a number of things that go beyond just purchase price, right? Historically, one of the big things was, well, how broad are the representations and warranties that we're going to require the seller to make? Right? I mean, that's a very kind of contentious point. We want the seller to represent everything under the sun. Mm-hmm. We want 25 pages of reps and warranties. And the seller's advisors are going to say, well, that's unreasonable. I mean, we'll give you kind of these 6 pages of reps and warranties, but we're not going to just tell you everything under the sun because we don't necessarily know that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you spend a lot of time deciding how broad are these representations going to be?
Yep.
And again, you know, for the sellers, this is you representing that the financial statements you've prepared are accurate, that the company that you're selling has paid all of its taxes, that you've operated the company in compliance with applicable laws, that you're not aware of any litigation other than what's on a list that you provided to the buyer. As you can imagine, depending on the sector or industry that the company operates in, these reps will be a bit different. You know, we see in Austin and on the West Coast, technology heavy businesses. Mm-hmm. And so there's lots of representations around intellectual property. You know, do you own the IP? Does it infringe on others? These are things parties care about because it directly impacts the value. Well, when you're negotiating what a seller is willing to say to a buyer, and then who's going to be on the hook if that representation is untrue, it can take a lot of time to get to the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the use of insurance has shown that if we can, again, effectuate a risk transfer away from the buyer and seller into an insurance company, that process is more seamless and efficient. Sellers are able to make broader reps because from a contract standpoint, they're not really standing behind those reps. As long as you can make those reps without quote unquote committing fraud, which we don't see very often, but it's really the only recourse that there would be to the seller. As long as they can make those reps, the insurance policy will generally cover them. And then you end up with hopefully a much more efficient and quicker timeline to get to signing.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a few of the representations like the financial documents or taxes being paid. What other examples can you give us in terms of what you can protect against?
Yeah. So again, if you look at a particular business, there's going to be certain representations and warranties for that business that are going to be more important. But we actually put out a claim study every year. So we've got a team of dedicated litigators at Aon, and they do nothing but work on reps and warranties insurance claims. So if you have a claim under these policies, they're working with you and your advisors, your lawyers to have that claim processed and sent through. And so we look every year at where are we seeing claims. So a couple of interesting points. The first is we see claims on 20% almost of the policies that we issue. So 1 in 5 transactions are resulting in a claim.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an interesting point because, you know, certainly in the world of M&A where there's buyers and sellers just transacting directly with one another, there's a lot of transactions for a buyer to be making a claim against a seller. And to be very clear, if you have an escrow, right, an indemnity that you've provided 10% of your purchase price and put in escrow, simply having the buyer make a claim can now greatly lengthen the time that you have to wait to get back at that escrow. So under most purchase agreements, if a buyer asserts a claim, mm-hmm. that escrow does not get released until that claim is resolved. Mm-hmm. So you as a seller may have been thinking, hey, I just got to wait 12 months. I get my 10% back. Everything's great. The buyer could assert a frivolous claim.
Mm-hmm.
And under the contract that you've signed, you now have to wait for this frivolous claim to be resolved. And we've seen certain litigious buyers mm-hmm. who use this as a strategy to say, hey, I'm just going to throw in a bunch of claims that on the fringe could be valid, but probably aren't.
Right.
But we're going to use it to kind of hold the seller hostage and say, hey, if you're willing, we're willing to let these go, but we want 15% of what's in the escrow account because mm-hmm. we think that solves for these things. And so you see, unfortunately, kind of this strategy that some buyers use to kind of hold the process up. And so again, by implementing the insurance policy, the seller, quite frankly, is not involved in that process. And so the claims that we're seeing under these policies, these 20%, tend to fall in, I'd say, one of a handful of categories. The first is the accuracy of financial statements. So even if you have audited financial statements, it is not uncommon for there to be something inaccurate in those financials. You know, sometimes something that was identified as recurring revenue
mm-hmm.
is in fact non-recurring. Mm. You could have a financial statement line item that deals with some type of expense or loss that you've identified as non-recurring, but it is in fact a recurring loss. And these are things now as a buyer, if you're using some type of valuation methodology that includes a multiple where you say, hey, we're going to pay 6x EBITDA for this business, you're counting on those financial statements with respect to historic earnings to be accurate.
Right.
And if they're not, it's not just that audit year loss that you're kind of taking on as a buyer, but mm-hmm. it's that times your multiple because
right.
you've overpaid for that company. So certainly for reviewed or unaudited financials, it's a much significant or more heightened risk. And, you know, candidly for family-owned businesses, sometimes the cost of an audit doesn't justify getting audited financials. So it's very common to see, you know, transactions that have unaudited financial statements. And these can result in sizable claims to the extent there's something wrong. So that's still to this day, probably the biggest, I'd say the most frequently cited claim and the one that results in the largest payouts. We also see a lot of tax claims. You mentioned that a minute ago, but you operate a business, you're required to pay certain taxes. Sometimes it's clear to an owner or a company where those taxes need to be paid. But to the extent you have some type of nexus or jurisdiction in another state, perhaps you sold something online and a certain state says, if you cross a certain threshold of selling X amount of or generating X amount of revenues from customers in our state, mm-hmm. you have to pay taxes. You might not know that. But now all of a sudden the buyer gets a routine audit and it's saying, hey, you guys didn't pay sales tax in Louisiana. It looks like there's a $300,000 tax that's owed. Mm. Now they're clawing back at the tax. Compliance with laws, right? Every business operates in a kind of a different regulatory regime, but I'd say some basic things to consider are you classifying his employees as exempt versus non-exempt correctly? If you use any type of contractors, have you done that in a way that's going to satisfy compliance laws? Do you use, you know, proper hiring techniques with respect to immigration, right? There's a whole host of things that would be triggered under compliance. So we see a ton of claims around compliance matters. One that we've seen kind of more frequently is employment and benefit matters. You know, are you operating 401k plans or other retirement plans in accordance with the Affordable Care Act, right? If you're not, there can be sizable taxes or penalties that are owed with respect to that compliance. And then again, I think there's certain industries, you know, technology businesses are going to have more outsized claims around intellectual property, patents, trademarks. You know, certainly in real estate, we see kind of unique claims around things like latent defects in the real property that's being sold. For oil and gas transactions and really anything kind of in the energy or infrastructure space, the condition of the assets. Right, you sold someone a 300-mile pipeline, and you represented that it's well maintained, that you've spent the right amount of money to reserve for the right amount of money for kind of future CapEx around maintenance and repairs, and the buyer, kind of 6 months in, finds a section of the pipe that was not maintained, and now has to spend millions of dollars to repair it, and absent an insurance policy, they're coming back to the seller and saying, "Hey, on your 300-mile pipeline, we found a 1-mile section that was heavily corroded. Mm-hmm. We got to spend $2 million to repair it. It's going to take 6 weeks. So we're going to have to shut the pipeline down." So now we've got a claim, not only for what it costs us to repair the pipe, but we're having to shut down
the business.
Yep. And so all of a sudden that seller's like, oh no, like it's not just the cost to repair it, but now these guys can't flow whatever product through the pipe. Now it's a much larger claim. And so it's interesting, Josh, when we were in 2020 during the COVID years, you know, M&A was very slow and buyers would have months to diligence a company and kind of find everything that they thought there was to find. And you might see less claims out of transactions in that year. Coming into 2021, massive year of M&A. I mean, I think if you talk to probably your friends that were in the space, they've never worked on as many transactions as they worked in 2021. They did a lot less diligence. They didn't have the time. I mean, these transactions were moving on very short timelines. Right. And so 2022, 23, 24 are kind of somewhere in the middle. Some transactions, the buyer has enough time to do due diligence. Sometimes they don't. But we're definitely seeing things that aren't being caught right in the diligence process, and it's resulting in claims. And again, the idea behind the M&A insurance world is let's facilitate all of that for these parties. And we'll talk about price here in a second. Let's charge a premium that is economic and cost sensitive to the buyer and seller, where it's not cost prohibitive to put the policy in place, but also hopefully affords enough premium to the insurers to build their coffers to pay claims. I would say today, if you look at the American Bar Association, who does a deal point study, and you look at other statistics, probably somewhere around 55 to 60% of all private M&A are now insured transactions. Mm. And so it very much has become kind of a common way to do M&A.
So when we were having lunch earlier, you mentioned something about like the last 10 years is really when this space built some momentum. And I think it was primarily in the bigger deals, the bigger transactions. But now, as we were walking here to record this, you were talking about a $13 million deal that you can potentially insure. So it sounds like this is now something that is more and more prevalent on the lower kind of middle market space nowadays. And you've mentioned private equity being the primary or one of the primary buyers of this. Are you seeing strategics buy this too? Are you seeing family offices utilize this as well in their transactions?
What to me was so fascinating is really the prevalence now of this across all transaction sizes, all geographies, and really kind of who are the users of this insurance. So 10 years ago, as a practicing attorney, I mean, less than 2% of the transactions that we worked on, did we really see M&A insurance being used? Mm-hmm. What has happened over the last 10 years is that, as you mentioned, this was initially a tool that private equity used. And they used it really to effectuate a clean exit, right? So these were private equity sellers for all the same reasons that a family office or an individual would have to want to get their money back. Private equity wants to get their money
private
back.
Private equity sellers.
Private equity sellers.
Sellers, you're right.
Want to get their money back right on day one. And they have limited partners and investors that they have a cost of capital mm-hmm. for holding on to proceeds. So they right. want to distribute funds. So they really pushed this. And mm-hmm. so in the beginning, those were larger transactions. I would say most transactions were kind of $250 million and up. What has happened is that this market has become so ubiquitous, right? We've seen an expansion from probably in the beginning, call it 5 or 6 insurers. Now there's 25. Mm. So the amount of insurance capital available is significantly more than it's ever been. There's also intense competition.
Creates more competition. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Sharper pencils.
Intense competition yep. amongst the insurers to win business, mm-hmm. which has driven rates down. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned pricing earlier. I would say as a general ballpark, the cost of insurance, and we'll go into this a bit more in a minute, but yeah. think of it as kind of 2 to 4% of the premium.
Okay.
Sorry, 2 to 4% of the amount of insurance, right?
Right?
So
okay.
just quick and dirty math, $100 million transaction, buyer typically would want a 10% holdback or $10 million. Mm-hmm. To replace a $10 million escrow with a $10 million insurance policy, mm-hmm. it's going to be 2 to 3% or $200,000 to $300,000, mm-hmm. right? So we're at the lowest rate environment we've seen. And if you just think about a cost of capital argument, you know, for a seller, to be able to free up $10 million at a cost of 2 to 3% versus what they can effectively make on that same $10 million if they have access to it, there's a right. significant arbitrage there. But to go back to your question, this was a private equity tool, and it became, you know, very apparent that they were going to continue to use this on the sell side. They then started utilizing it on the buy side as a way to be more competitive in transactions mm-hmm. early on to differentiate themselves from one another. And so where we sit today, because of the intense amount of competition amongst insurers, we now are able to really insure transactions from, I'd say, as small as 3 to 5 million on the low end, and really no cap on large transactions, right? I mean, I think mm-hmm. you know, we've seen transactions kind of $20 to $30 billion being insured, mm-hmm. but it's really that expansion on the lower end of the market where we've seen just right. a lot of prevalence because historically you couldn't insure those transactions. Mm-hmm. The other interesting point is what type of transaction. So when we talk about M&A, most people think about I'm selling my company and someone's buying it. But there's also a number of ways to carve out transactions. Sometimes it's a recapitalization. You have a client who, they're not ready to completely exit, but they want to sell a 30% minority stake to a new partner, and they're going to use that infusion of money to grow the business and do great things. We're insuring minority transactions. You know, if you have a client that's fortunate enough to go through an IPO via a SPAC, mm-hmm. we've insured SPAC transactions. One of the interesting kind of trends that we've seen is on the minority side, you know, preferred equity. Right, which can have some unique mechanisms, and whether or not you know they actually own equity in the underlying company depends on whether or not they're able to serve as debt payments. We've been able to insure preferred equity transactions. And then in the last 2 years, what's really taken off are what we call secondary transactions. So mm-hmm. for your private equity clients, you know, there's been challenges in returning distributions to limited partners because M&A has been slow. And so you now see some of those limited partners asking for the private equity sponsor to help them sell those LP interests, right, to another LP.
Right.
It's not really selling the company, it's just selling the underlying investor's equity. Those transactions have become insurable. So I think what's pretty interesting and pretty unique, honestly, about this whole market is it keeps evolving to address what clients need. So mm-hmm. there's been certain sectors, right, that weren't historically insurable. When I joined Aon back in 16, you know, energy was a tough space to get insurance for. I think the insurers just didn't really understand M&A transactions in oil and gas. And, mm-hmm. and so, you know, we worked to develop kind of proprietary products that would enable us to insure an oil and gas transaction. Healthcare was a challenging space. You know, we can now insure healthcare transactions. So if you look at the snapshot of the market today, again, more carriers than we've ever seen, more capital, kind of the best rates, which I know the insurers aren't happy about, but certainly good for the buyers of the policy, the cheapest rates we've seen. And really, you know, very little in the way of non-insurable transactions, right? I mean, we do transactions all over the US, but also throughout Europe, South America, Asia. You know, certain jurisdictions may have certain things that are challenging to cover. But as a general matter, you know, I would say there's very few transactions right now that insurers won't touch. I think the only kind of two spaces that we continually get no's on are anything kind of cannabis related, mm-hmm. just because of the friction between federal law and state law.
Yep.
So it's not a hard no, but if your clients are in the cannabis business, that can be a challenging one. And then Bitcoin mining. There's been a lot of big claims made around kind of mining farms and different businesses tied mm-hmm. to Bitcoin. So you know, anyone in that space, we've certainly done policies in that space, but that's the other kind of sector that still can be a bit challenging.
Yeah. UBS is not in either of those spaces really. So I think we're good on that one. So what about in a typical transaction, we'll see the seller rolling some of that equity into the new co. How does this impact that, if at all?
I actually think that in the scenario where a seller is rolling equity or is going to be staying on as an operating partner, you know, maybe they have a key man provision and they're going to stay on for 2 to 3 years. I actually think those transactions are probably the best suited to use insurance. And here's why. When you're selling a portion of your company or you're rolling equity into the new co going forward, you've now partnered with the buyer. And you're both aligned, right? That you want to grow this business. If you have equity, you want the valuation to go up.
Sure.
And you resell in 3 years, you want a higher valuation. When we're seeing claims on these policies, these are not things that the seller knows about most of the time, right? These are, you know, the seller has disclosed what they know to the buyer. But these are things, I mean, litigation's a prime example, right? You know, sellers selling their company, they say, we're not aware of any litigation. And then 6 months after closing, some employee comes out of the woodwork and says, oh, you know, when I was working, I slipped and fell and I want $8 million. Mm-hmm. Or what's interesting is, you know, sometimes you see transactions publicly announced and all of a sudden some kind of, you know, material contractor or someone that had privity with the seller sees that there's now deep pockets that bought the company and they're going to go assess a breach of contract that existed, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. So these claims that come up are generally not things the seller knows about. And so what happens is when you have a traditional indemnity escrow between buyer and seller, right? That seller is now on your team. He's now part of the buying group, right? Mm-hmm. He's part of NewCo. And now you as the buyer, all of a sudden, find out, hey, let's go back to the tax example. You guys, when you operated this business, you failed to pay $3 million in taxes to the state of Louisiana. Now you're seeking recourse against your CEO,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, and he's, guys, no one told us we had to pay taxes in Louisiana. We sold a few products online and we didn't know the customers were going to trigger this. And so you create this friction of a buyer's now trying to figure out, you know, hey, this is a material loss and we've got an escrow for a reason, but it's against our CEO or the management team that came over. And so, I mean, one of the biggest reasons I think that private equity found this valuable for those funds that would buy companies with management coming over is they said, you know what, guys, we trust you've run this business well. We don't think you're doing anything nefarious. So we're going to get an insurance policy. So if something does come up, we're not fussing with you. We're able to make a claim against a policy. We're made whole. And we're not having to seek recourse against our partners. So I think in kind of the rolling equity scenario, which we see frequently, I mean, that's really one of the playbooks for private equity is to buy a company, have the management team continue on for some period of time to run it and help grow it. You don't want to seek recourse against your operating partners. And so that's become a very kind of prevalent strategy for private equity in those scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It makes all the sense in the world. So let's talk about when things have gone poorly in a transaction negotiation where insurance kind of made a key difference.
Yeah. So I would say, you know, some of the biggest areas can be around, again, kind of known issues, right? So let's just take, for example, an S corp, right? So you've got a client who's operating his company. It's elected to be treated as an S corporation. For buyers who would be acquiring that company, that can prove to be a pretty substantial tax risk if they, for some reason, feel like it's not validly elected to be an S-Corp, right? They didn't fill out the necessary paperwork. And if the IRS were to challenge it and say, hey, you're not an S-Corp, we have to unwind this. There's a huge tax hit to the buyer. Another example, litigation. Target is subject to some frivolous lawsuit. Seller believes it's frivolous. Buyer believes it's frivolous. But, you know, as a lawyer, we've seen frivolous lawsuits prevail all the time. Mm-hmm. These can prove to be substantial material risks that can impact the ability of the parties to actually transact. And so, you know, one of the things that we see frequently come up is the parties say, hey, there's kind of this known issue. We think they're probably an S corp, but they don't have all the filings from 20 years ago because they opened this company up, incorporated it 20 years ago. Or, you know, this lawsuit, again, it looks frivolous, but what if it's not? What if a jury finds for the plaintiff? So where insurance can come in is it can basically say, again, instead of you guys having to figure out who wears that liability, right? Does the seller retain it as a liability and the buyer gets to kind of transact without it coming forward? Does the buyer assume it and adjust the purchase price downward? Insurance, in many cases, can insure for these known issues. And this comes up all the time. Sometimes we build it in directly to the reps and warranties insurance policy, where even though it's a known issue, we can get the insurance carrier comfortable that it's the likelihood of it coming to fruition is pretty low, mm-hmm. and they'll have the risk appetite to cover it. Sometimes it's a bit more of a coin toss. I mean, there could be a lawsuit and you say, hey, it's could be right. Plaintiff mm-hmm. could have a real claim here. And in those cases, we can actually place specialized policies that just cover that specific known risk. So you may have a transaction where you don't need a reps and warranties policy to cover everything, but what you're really focused on is one or two particular key items that are preventing the parties from transacting. And so actually what's kind of interesting that we've seen at some developments over the last couple of years, sellers will actually work with their bankers and they will actually kind of identify big red flag items up front. I, by the way, think this is a great thing to do regardless of whether you're thinking about insurance or anything else. It's just, what do we think a buyer could poke holes at, mm-hmm. right, on our valuation? What are they going to look at? And so oftentimes, sophisticated bankers will sit down with a seller and say, let's just go through the company top to bottom. Let's make sure that we identify these issues so that if the buyer comes to poke holes in this, even if just to adjust the purchase price downward, we have a good response and we can push back and avoid that purchase price negotiation. But sometimes they're real issues. And so by identifying those up front before you really have kind of buyers into the data room and really poking holes, some of those things we can go ahead and line up insurance policies that are ready to go if it becomes an issue. So it's a function of we're not buying a policy today, but we've got this lawsuit and we've gone ahead and discussed it with kind of the same M&A insurers that write RWI, Reps and Warranties Insurance. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten confidence from them that they can place a policy for this particular known issue. So you kind of carry that in your back pocket. And if and when the buyer raises it and it becomes a real issue to the mm-hmm. transaction getting closed, seller can say, okay, I'll tell you what, we'll buy an insurance policy to protect against this particular liability. We'll fully protect you, the buyer. Mm-hmm. Now can we move forward with the transaction? And these come up all the time. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, I mean, different industries, different businesses, it's going to be a different kind of hot topic item. But I think for sellers in particular, when you're preparing for a sales process, kind of knowing what these are up front and figuring out if it becomes an issue for us, can we insure it? And by doing that up front, it minimizes the time to get these things done. I mentioned earlier, we can put these policies in place in 2 weeks or less. For these known issues, those sometimes take a bit more time. And so again, knowing about them early enough in the process to line coverage up enables us to ensure that the transaction doesn't hit any snags.
Mm-hmm. Here's something that just kind of popped in my head. As you think about this space and how it's evolved so much over the past few years, you know, going from a handful of insurers to now 25, 30, you know, different companies, the competition has gotten pretty fierce in this space. Do rates play a role in pricing at all?
Interest rates?
Yes. Do they have any impact on this at all?
We haven't seen a direct correlation mm-hmm. between interest rates and the cost of the insurance. I mean, certainly interest rates impacted volume of M&A, right?
Well, sure,
so,
of course.
So
yep.
Because for the last 2 years, you mm-hmm. know, there's a variety of reasons, but interest rates rising caused there to be a slowdown in M&A because you had to borrow money at a higher cost. All of a sudden, deals weren't as profitable. And so because interest rates caused a drop in M&A, mm-hmm. that meant there was less transactions to insure, and the insurance carriers, in order to win the small amount of business that was out there, had to drop rates.
Yep.
So I would say that there's that correlation just in terms of lower volume
okay.
means the competition's even fiercer, mm-hmm. and so they're dropping rates to try and win the business that's there. I would say for people thinking about cost, you know, I mentioned earlier, you know, typically somewhere kind of 2-4%, mm-hmm. right? So I think now's a good time to go back to the pricing.
Yep.
When you think about that range, right, that assumes we're insuring about 10% of purchase price. So mm-hmm. take any transaction size, you know, $100 million deal, $10 million policy is going to cost $200,000 to $400,000, right? Two on the low side, four on the high side. What impacts that pricing? Well, the first thing that impacts the pricing is going to be the size of the transaction, okay? For very large transactions, call it $500 million and up, there's just a heightened focus by the insurer that, hey, if there is a problem here, it could be a really big problem by the nature of the size of the company.
Sure.
So they may charge a bit higher rate for kind of their initial insurance that they're putting forth.
Mm-hmm.
Now we need $100 million of insurance. When you have $100 million of insurance you need, you can't get that from one insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
As a general matter, of those 25 insurers I mentioned, most are willing to put up about $25 million.
Okay.
So what happens is you build what's called a tower.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get four insurance carriers, each providing $25 million of insurance, and they attach on top of each other. So in order for the second guy to have to pay out, the mm-hmm. first guy has to get his $25 million fully
credit. Yeah.
You know, utilized.
Right.
So you get to negotiate cheaper rates as you go up
as
the
tower. As you stack up, yep.
So when we think about that 2 to 4% range I gave, we're going to get to the lower end of that range as we start to build a large tower because we're going to have a blended rate all in that's much cheaper. So the size of the transaction is going to be one of the first kind of corollaries, if you will, to what's the cost of the insurance. Mm-hmm. The other is the deductible. These policies typically have a deductible that would mirror what's in a purchase agreement. Think about it as if you didn't have insurance and a buyer was negotiating this escrow or holdback from a seller, the seller is going to ask for some threshold that, hey, before you can go after the escrow, 50 basis points of purchase price has to be, the loss has to exceed 50 basis points. So the insurers try to match that and put that in the policy. But yeah, but some buyers—
the nickel and dime.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Some buyers are willing to say, hey, you know, we're not really worried about small claims, so we're willing to accept a higher deductible.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we really want to protect against is something catastrophic.
Right.
So let's take a 1% deductible or 5% deductible because we want to drive
lower
the cost
premium,
down.
Right.
So higher deductibles drive costs down. And then the other thing that impacts pricing is just the potential risk profile. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're talking about fiber cable in Latin America, that's going to be a more expensive risk than, you know, a tech service, an IT provider in Austin, Texas, right? And it's just there's less that can go wrong with a guy providing IT support or a company providing IT support than, you know, thousands of miles of cable being laid in a billion-dollar transaction in Latin America.
Right. Okay, so get your crystal ball out. How do you see this space evolving in the future?
One of the kind of exciting things is it is still fairly nascent. I mean, again, you know, you talk to friends of yours that are partners at law firms, I'll tell you 10 years ago, I mean, it was just not something they saw.
Right.
So the crystal ball for me is this. I think continued expansion, one thing you asked earlier, actually didn't address, you know, who's using it with private equity, family offices frequently using it now, private sellers all the time, like family-owned businesses. I mean, oftentimes you've got multiple shareholders, right? It's not just one guy. It may be, you know, him and his, he went and did a friends and family, you know, investment round. And so you've got 15 shareholders in a company and, you know, having all 15 of those guys have to kind of sign up to an indemnity, it just doesn't work, right? So it really, these policies work great when you've got family-owned businesses with multiple shareholders. Now you get to let everybody kind of walk. And buyers like that as well too, because, you know, they don't have to worry about this clawback from different individuals. But corporate strategic use, probably 40, almost 50% now. It used to be maybe 20 to 30%, probably closer to 40 or 50, depending on the year. And that's a function of, candidly, to be competitive in an auction process where there's, you know, it's a really good asset or business, a corporate buyer historically may have said, hey, we're not going to use anything other than we want to hold back from you guys. Like, that's how we do business. Now, in order to be competitive, they're being told, well, if that's your insistence, you're not going to win. Even if you're willing to offer a little bit more money, these guys are willing to let the seller kind of get a clean exit. And that's more important to the seller than an incremental 1% or 2% in purchase price. So as I look in the future, right, a lot of what we evolve and adapt and develop is a direct response to what clients and lawyers come to us and say, hey, can you help fix this? So there's examples I can give, like in the intellectual property space, IP has become such a big part of valuation. We're now, you know, there's products that insure the value of IP. There's a whole host of things that keep coming up from clients saying, hey, can you do this? Hey, is this available? So I think we're going to continue seeing expansion of what can be insured, right? I think the novel and nascent things, artificial intelligence has all of a sudden obviously become the big thing. What is that going to mean for M&A, right? Are we going to see AI being deployed for diligence? Is that going to be acceptable? Are we going to see businesses that are being sold that they're AI businesses? And what are the risks that are inherent with that? I think kind of the expansion.
Insure against hallucinations?
I mean,
AI hallucination?
Yeah, I think all of these things are new and novel that we just, you know, it's kind of fun because clients come to say, can you fix this? And so I think we're going to continue to see expansion. I do think at some point we'll see a little bit of rate increase. Again, we're at such low rates right now, and that's a direct result of M&A having really dropped off in 22 and 23. You know, we're seeing pretty significant tailwinds right now. So for your sellers who maybe have been on the sidelines, you know, certainly probably a good time to talk to their advisors about is now the right time, because folks have pretty much accepted the interest rate environment we're in is kind of what we're going to be in. We're not going to see material rate decreases in the next year or two. And so there's been, I think M&A, if you talk to different banks, UBS probably has these stats, up 20 to 30% year over year. And so you've had a lot of sellers that have been sitting on the sidelines and they're like, you know, now it feels like a good time to go transact. So I think with that tailwind of M&A, we'll see a bit of rate increase, maybe 25 to 50 basis points. Mm-hmm. So nothing significant, but I think we'll see a bit of rate increase. It's exciting for us. I mean, capacity keeps growing. We see new entrants into the market every year. And it's fun to get to see kind of just a whole slew of different types of transactions kind of all over the world that are now kind of coming online and using this as a proprietary deal tool.
So who pays for the premium? Is that typically the buyer, the seller? Do they split it?
I would say that
they split it.
Yeah, I mean, I think anecdotally, it's split more often than not. And the way, if you think about it, I mean, when a transaction closes, the funds flow is, you know, the buyer is sending wires, mm-hmm. sending wires to the seller. They're sending wires to the insurance company for the insurance policy. So, you know, they're quote unquote paying for it. But I would venture to say that more often than not, there is a purchase price adjustment for the cost of the insurance, usually somewhere around 50%. Mm-hmm. And we sometimes see in a purchase agreement, there will be a very specific allocation about transaction expenses, including insurance, will be borne by the buyer and seller, you know, 50-50. Mm-hmm. Again, I think for sellers right now, with the cost of the insurance being so low, I mean, we've seen some sellers just say flat out, we'll pay for it if we have to, because we want to close this transaction and wind down the entity and move on. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't want to leave an entity out there for a year. And again, worry about a claim coming in that then prolongs the ability to go get to the escrow. So more often than not, the costs are split. But if you have what I'll call an obstinate buyer, maybe someone who's not used to the insurance policy, is accustomed to getting an escrow, we've seen them push back and say, you know, we want an escrow or you have to pay for the insurance. And then the seller will say, you know, it's fine. Purchase price adjust for the cost of the insurance, mm-hmm. but give us all of the proceeds at closing.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're adjusting, I was wondering what the tax deduction or any tax related considerations here.
Well, I think the cost of the insurance is built in as a transaction expense, just like, you know, you're paying for legal fees, sure. and accounting fees. So it's kind of built into the purchase price. So I don't know if there's kind of a quote unquote specific tax advantage or disadvantage. Yeah. I think it's just a transaction expense. I will mention this actually brings up something, raised a point in my head. 95%+ of the time, these policies are for the buyer, right? So the buyer is the insured party. The buyer makes a claim against the policy if something comes up, and the seller is, again, you know, right. effectuating a clean exit. We do see on certain transactions where a buyer says, not going to use insurance, require a holdback. In those transactions, we do see sellers come to us and ask us to insure the escrow amount, right? Basically, they want to guarantee that escrow will come back. It's not as common as, mm-hmm. as you actually would think. I think sellers more often than not say, we know there's nothing wrong. We know we're going to get the escrow. We just have to wait a year. But sometimes, given the nature of the parties, again, let's use the example of there's 15 shareholders. Mm-hmm. Some weren't even involved in the operations of the business. They're just friends and family. And you're putting in, let's just call it $25 million into escrow, right? Or whatever the number is. You will see the seller say, you know what? We had to put this money in escrow. We want to kind of just on the sell side. So it's buyer's not even aware this policy gets put in place, but the seller will take out a sell side reps and warranties insurance policy, and they will insure the amount of the escrow so that in the unlikely event, the buyer actually makes a claim. Mm-hmm. against the escrow and is successful and actually gets to go into that account and let's just say pull out $7 or $8 million, the seller is then making a claim against the insurance policy and being reimbursed for the amount that the buyer pulled out. Mm-hmm. And so what it's doing is it's just giving a seller certainty that they're going to get that escrow, even if they have
to. They're still doing it. They're just, yeah, they're doing it on
their
own. They
still have to go through all the mechanics of dealing with the buyer and going through a claim. But I'll give you a great example. You have private equity portfolio companies where the management team really, you know, all of their waterfall is where they make their money, right? Mm-hmm. So they make a great salary, but when they sell the company, there's this waterfall and, you know, LPs have to get paid, GPS to get paid, and then the management team has this kind of big pool of money, and that's where they make, you know, that's where they make their money, mm-hmm. is on the sale of the company. Sometimes the escrow, the holdback, can be so significant that really reflects the management's waterfall. I mean, that's mm-hmm. where the money will come from. And so we've seen management teams say, you know what? I mean, we've worked 7 years to get here, mm-hmm. and I don't want to see that money evaporate on the basis of something we didn't know about. So again, kind of same cost, 2-4%, they'll insure that escrow amount so that in this unlikely event, the buyer makes a claim and is able to pull at that, they actually get reimbursed by the insurance policy and their escrow is basically made whole to them. So mm-hmm. it's a very useful tool for sellers who actually maybe have some concerns about who the buyer is or just want kind of that certainty of, I need to make sure we get our money. Right. So we're not worried about a claim, but God forbid the buyer makes a claim and is a successful. I can't afford to have this escrow kind of get wiped out.
Right. Okay. Well, fantastic, Matt. Thanks for all that. I've learned a lot in this little short conversation. I'm sure the audience has too. Who typically brings this up? I mean, we'll close this out here, but who typically brings it up? I mean, is the business owner supposed to like call you up and be like, hey, I'm working on this transaction? It's usually the banker that's bringing it up.
I would say it's pretty split between the lawyers and or the actual seller. I mean, look, a lot of sellers, you know, that haven't done a lot of transactions aren't even aware this is out there.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, they're like, I've been running my company, I haven't been selling.
Right,
so
exactly.
In that case, it's oftentimes the lawyer who's sitting down with them saying, hey, as we start to think about putting a PSA out, you know, we should talk about this as an option. But we certainly have very, you know, sophisticated, astute sellers, you know, who are on company three or four and they're familiar with it. And so they'll bring it up. But I'd say 50% of the time, it's the law firm. 35 to 40% of the time, it's the seller. And then, you know, 10%, it's a third party advisor like a banker or a CPA.
Right. Okay. Anything else as we kind of close things up?
I think we've covered a lot. I mean, insurance can be a fairly dense subject, but I think what's unique about this space is it is very specific to M&A. So I think what you'll find is this doesn't look like your homeowner's or auto insurance policy. This is a bespoke M&A contract between the insured party, typically the buyer, and the insurer. We and the lawyers who are involved in this get to negotiate every word of the policy. So it is a very bespoke solution that is really intended to fit every transaction for those specific requirements. So this isn't a
one size fits all kind of thing.
Yeah, we're not going out to 25 insurers and like, here's your policy.
Right.
This is a, we want to work with AIG or Chubb or whoever the insurance market is. And they're going to give us a policy form that we and the lawyers will negotiate every word. And so it really is, again, at the end of the day, this is supposed to be structured as a very significant benefit for both buyer and seller. Seller wants a clean exit. Buyer wants broader protection than they could ever negotiate from a seller, from a reputable third party who's going to actually be able to pay the claim. And so this whole industry has been born out of the idea of it shouldn't just benefit one or the other, it should benefit both. And so I think that that's why the adoption has achieved the level it has and why, you know, when buyers see this now, they don't kind of balk and say, what is this? They're generally fairly familiar with it. So we love to hear people reaching out and saying, hey, what about this? What about that? I would love to tell you that I sit around and come up with all the great ideas. It's not true. It's our clients. It's people like you. It's advisors who say, hey, I have a client and this is the issue. Can you guys come up with a solution? We love to hear these things because that's how we keep developing and creating new solution lines.
You've sold me. It's a no-brainer. I mean, from a buyer's perspective, protects them against that risk. From the seller's perspective, helps them capture more of the proceeds. The deal team, it improves the speed to close, removes some of the friction that are involved. And it just seems like a win-win-win kind of, you know, situation.
Yeah. And I'm surprised I'm just saying this at the end. Claims are being paid. We have seen just at Aon, just on our book, over $1 billion of loss paid out. Over, I think, 1.4 recognized, right? Sometimes the losses are small and fall within kind of the deductible. You know, these insurance carriers want to be viewed as partners to the parties, right? So they want ongoing business. This is not a recurring revenue, recurring cost policy. When you pay a premium, it's a one-time payment and you have coverage under that policy for up to 7 years, right? So these insurance carriers in the space want to be viewed as partners to the buyers and sellers. So this underwriting process, it's not contentious. Again, they want the buyers to come back to them on each transaction and say, I want to work with that insurer.
Right.
And so on claims, which arguably is the most important part of this entire policy, what is a policy if you can't get a claim? There are amazing insurers who do a great job at evaluating claims and paying real claims. And our claims team has been critical to helping our clients obtain these recoveries. But we see claims get paid. And I think as long as we continue, you talked about glass ball, as long as we continue to see commercial behavior by insurers on the claim side, I think this continues to be a very pointed way of doing M&A for the foreseeable future.
Well, we're starting to see some green shoots, more transactions happen. So that sounds like that's going to be hopefully that'll be good for everyone.
I really appreciate you having me out. It's always fun to get to reconnect with old friends. And as I think I mentioned earlier, this is my first time actually being in a podcast studio. So it's very cool to put the headphones on and get to talk shop.
Well, good. Well, thanks again, Matt. Wish you all the best and safe travels back down to Houston and enjoyed having lunch and catching up with you. So to all of our listeners out there, if you're still with us, I hope you enjoyed this conversation and learned a bit. And if you are interested or want to learn more, just reach out to us and happy to make the connection here. So with that, we'll let you go. Be safe, be well, and until next time, take care. Thank you for tuning in to Lightning in a Bottle. It's been a pleasure bringing you today's insights from the brightest minds in business. To stay updated with relevant content, exclusive events, and our latest podcast episodes, send us a note to atxwealthpartners.com. Until next time, keep capturing the lightning of innovation and turning it into success. I'm Josh Pottinger, wishing you a productive and prosperous week ahead. And don't forget, know your options, be informed, and plan early. Take care and be well.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.